Hi, everyone. This is Chris Grosso with the Indie Spirituals podcast on the Be Here Now Network. And my guest today is Laura McGowan. Laura, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. So I wanted to read your bio for anyone that is not familiar with your work and this incredible new book that you have out that we are going to be discussing throughout the next roughly hour, give or take. Laura McGowan is the author of We Are the Luckiest. She is a former public relations executive who has become recognized as a fresh voice in the recovery movement. Beloved for her soulful and irreverent writing, she leads sold-out yoga-based retreats and other courses that teach people how to say yes to a bigger life. She lives in Marblehead, Massachusetts, and you can learn more about her at www.lauramcowan.com. That's spelled LauraMcKowen.com. Or if you're checking this out on the Be Here Now Network website, simply scroll down. We will have that linked. We'll have the link to her wonderful book, We Are the Luckiest, there as well. So, Laura, thank you so much again for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and we are practically neighbors. I live in Connecticut, just south of you. So
I know, I saw that.
Yes.
Yeah, waving to you today in this
unseasonably
warm day.
Yes, eerily warm lately. It was, I don't know for you, but I think last weekend we were in the 60s here.
It reached 70 here.
Oh, my goodness.
I know.
So, yeah, that's a whole nother show, Global
Warming. Yeah, that's a whole other show.
So what I like to do with some guests is, most guests, especially first-time guests to the show, is kind of have them just give a bit of a background. So, I mean, it's some people keep their anonymity about being in recovery and fellowships, and obviously that's
I do not.
No, and nor do I. So perfect fit. So, you know, we're going to be talking a lot about that because that's what this book is about. And I would love for you, if you don't mind, just kind of going back, and I really enjoy starting the show with hearing a bit about the guests' lives. And you can start wherever, whether it's childhood or teenage, wherever you feel like, sharing from. And the reason I mentioned the recovery thing is it's almost like a very nutshell speaker meeting for anyone familiar with 12 steps, but I do that with people that are not in recovery. I'm just fascinated by the human stories and conditions and experiences. So if you don't mind kind of giving us a little background, I would love to jump off from there.
Sure. So I grew up in, I was born and raised in Colorado in a small town south of Denver. I lived there all through my life. I was, pretty normal middle class family. My parents got divorced when I was young. I have one brother, and I went to college in Colorado. And then right afterwards, I moved here. I drove across country and moved to Boston with a really good friend for no other reason than just to have an adventure. And she stayed for a couple of years and went back, as most people do, go back to Colorado or go towards Colorado. And I just fell in love with it here and stayed. I went to grad school here, got married here, had a kid here, got divorced here, got sober here. So my, the book that I wrote is about drinking. And I guess I'll tell you a little bit about that, story. I grew up in a family where drinking was very normal, normalized. And I just thought everybody, all adults drank. I thought that was just the natural progression of how things go when you got to be of age, or even before, you were going to drink alcohol. And that's what adults did. And that's how they socialized. And it was part of every single event, no matter what it was. We had a restaurant, so that played into that quite a bit, that environment. And I grew up, I mentioned that my parents divorced when I was young, which is by no means a unique thing, but it definitely is the pull. For me, it was when I started to sort of learn to shape shift who I was, to make people happy or make people feel okay about what was going on. So I learned that if I wanted my parents to be okay, I needed to act like everything was fine and that I was happy and that I was not upset. And I'm being very vague when I say that, but sure. The general sense is that I learned that pretty early. And I think I just had a, very sensitive person, or just, I pick up on a lot and never really learned, like most of us, never really learned many tools to deal with that. I just learned that being strong meant you just kept going and you put a smile on your face. And, and I started to reach for things pretty early on to ease the discomfort that I had inside. Mm-hmm. I didn't see it that way at the time, of course, but I can see it now, whether it was food. At the end, towards the end of high school, I got a pretty bad eating disorder, and then I started drinking, and alcohol was really, like, I had this moment where I, at the end of high school, I was about to go off to college, and I was pretty wound up at the time, meaning just like a lot of feelings going on, a lot of fear. I had a lot of stuff going on in my family. And I remember drinking at this party and just feeling like everything was okay once I had a few drinks, and that just a few hours ago, it had not been okay. And most of the time, as I went through my days at that time, I was not okay. I didn't feel okay. But when I had a few drinks, I was fine. And I thought, if I could just stay like this, everything will be okay. And I really chased that. Like, I really tried to keep that going and did so somewhat successfully for, I had some bad nights, and I definitely had some bad nights, and I had some consequences. But for the most part, my drinking looked pretty normal. I surrounded myself with people who also drank a lot. I started a career. All my friends drank. I went to grad school. I was always around people who drank the same way I did. And so I didn't, while I did have this growing sort of nagging sense that I drank a little bit differently and that I liked it a little more than other people did. Right. I had a lot of anxiety around it. I still didn't think, like, this is a problem per se. It was just something I had to be sort of vigilant about. Like, I had to sort of watch it.
Right.
But it really upticked when I had my it upticked when I got married, and then it upticked big time when I had my daughter. And I hear that a lot from women, from mothers, because our bodies change and our hormones change and we're not sleeping and we have this massive responsibility. And I just remember feeling like, oh, it's not working anymore.
Right.
Like, the alcohol isn't working anymore. And so I just drank more because I wanted it to work. I wanted to get that same like relief, but it really only made me incredibly anxious.
Yeah.
And then I separated from my husband, and I separated when my daughter was 3. And that's when my drinking got really, really bad. And I start the book out with this moment that was, if I have a bottom moment at the bottom, the rock bottom sort of myth is somewhat of a myth, because right. It wasn't the end of my drinking, but it was certainly the point where I was forced to face that this was not just something I could, that I was not going to be able to wrangle this and control it. So I left my daughter unattended for a night when she was very young, and it was, my family was there. So it wasn't just something I could sweep under the rug. That was known by other people. And that's when shortly after is when I went to my first 12-step meeting. And I didn't get sober though until about a year and several months later. So that year was really like this brutal sort of purgatory for me. And I really didn't want I really didn't want to get sober. I really didn't, despite all the evidence I had that drinking was ruining my life. I just didn't, I couldn't believe that that was my only option, you know?
Right.
So a lot of my book actually focuses on that, sort of this disbelieving state, this bargaining state, grief state that we enter when we are forced with something that is so painful that we can't quite accept it.
Right.
Yeah.
I just wanted to interject that, I mean, I could relate to so much of that. What you just said, the grief state, was something that I didn't recognize at first in my own experience with laying aside alcohol or stopping drinking, which for me, I didn't get it my first try or second try or third or fourth. I was one of those, you know, I don't like to, you know, quantify and use these labels, but for lack of a better word, I was a chronic relapser. And mm-hmm. and that's after, like, I would have a year or two or three or 5 years at one point and still mm-hmm. end up going back. And part of what I mean, I've since been, and still am, in therapy, and trauma-based therapy, and which has been very helpful. But the grief point you made is so huge, because what I wasn't recognizing for part of it was that it truly is like losing a friend
when
you stop drinking, you know?
Yeah.
Not just that, but someone who, you know, they're not judging you. They're not talking back. They're not.
It's always there.
Always there. Right. And yeah. And it was just, wow. So I never took the time to truly, like, grieve that loss.
Right. And it's also so, it's like, it doesn't make sense because it's so destructive. Like,
yes.
You know, it's like a relationship that's so bad and everyone's like, thank God you're out of it. But the person that's in it, like, there's a massive grief process.
Yes.
That you go through. Yeah.
And there's plenty of cliches in the 12 steps that, you know, I don't say that in a negative way because, you know, they make sense. Cunning, baffling, insidious, like mm-hmm. these things that unless you've gone through it, if you're on the outside looking in, you know, it's very hard to understand that. And yet if you have gone through it and like we're talking about it, we know exactly what, you know, one another is talking about. So
yeah.
But yeah, the grief thing, I mean, we're definitely going to get into that. I kind of chuckled to myself that and I think you playfully spoke about how you stayed in Boston, because I travel and speak at a lot of conferences and festivals as well, and anytime mm-hmm. I'm out in Colorado or Phoenix or areas like that, I meet so many people from the East Coast.
Right. It's that, like, are like, what? Right.
Yeah, like, I moved out here kind of a polar opposite. Like, you know, it was just a vacation, whatever. And I'm like, I fell in love and I could never go back. And you're probably one of the first people I at least currently remember, like, hearing the complete opposite of that. So,
yeah, no, it is. It's the reverse route. But I don't know. There's, to me, the Northeast is magical.
Oh, I agree. I love the four seasons. I love snow. I know that's not a popular sentiment. Love that
it's old and so much history and
yes,
yeah,
it's beautiful here. So I mean, boy, there was so much in what you just shared. I was gonna unpack, and as I mentioned in the podcast I did with Brad yesterday, we were both like just getting over colds, or I have like the sinus thing,
oh. So
it's like a hot mess. But anyways, so I noticed that I have these thoughts and then they kind of
they just go leaped. And
but you know, one thing I was going to say was so about the recovery thing. So, you know, you were talking about you know, you're drinking and recognizing that it's not working, so you're doing it more, and of course, you know, again, mm-hmm. anyone who's been in those shoes understands tolerance builds, and you know, it's just one is too many, a thousand's never enough, another one of the 12 step cliches that are very true. And so something I in your own story, I know, and we're just going to kind of jump around throughout the book because there's, you know, it's wonderful, and I it's meant to be read, I think, cover to cover, but for conversational purposes, so many topics, we can just address it. I don't think we need to follow the format. But so one of the points you're talking about defining oneself, or I should say not defining oneself as an addict, alcoholic. And, you know, when I was reading that, I couldn't have agreed more. And for me, at least, the reason why is that I got to a point where And there, you know, I'm all for whatever works for you. Go for it. Like, I would never tell anyone what to do or not to do, but I'm at a point where, like, I don't count time anymore. I don't consider myself this or that. Like, I know I live with a part of myself that has alcoholism and I can't drink because of that. But even like with clean time, I stopped a long time ago counting because I recognize I might not be drinking, but I will catch myself acting out in other ways that are the same obsessive compulsive way that I would drink, exactly the same. It's just, you know, the symptoms of my illness are manifesting in a different way. So, you know, something I'm very cognizant of. And so am I really sober? I mean, on one hand, yes, I'm not drinking, but like I could be going on an eating binge. You mentioned an eating disorder. I've struggled with those when I was younger too.
Yep.
Not so much now, but sure. Like there are days where I will do something like that or numb out with TV and know that it's the same behavior, just a different substance. So anyways, all that to say, I would love to hear, because this isn't a popular sentiment among a lot of people that are in recovery, but I'm right there with you on it. And I was so glad to read it. And I would love to hear you elaborate more on that.
Sure. So, okay. So when labels can be very useful, like we need to know what things are. We need to know whether we're putting like sugar or salt in our coffee. You know, the labels can be useful to define a thing. But nobody thinks or says the word alcoholic and thinks something good or even neutral. It's like, it is a very, to me, not to everybody, but it's a very punitive term. And in that one word, there says so much about, there's all these assumptions that go into it because of how we have portrayed alcoholism and the addict, right?
Right.
So I just, I first of all, just don't choose to call myself that because it just doesn't feel good.
Right.
And it doesn't feel expansive either. Like I have no illusion about my problem with alcohol. I know I can't drink. I will never drink again. But so it's not born of that place, which I think is where a lot of the fear comes in.
Right.
It's like, if you don't call yourself that, then you're not accepting it. It's like, nah, I fully accept it.
Yeah.
I just don't want to call myself that because it feels punitive to me.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, it's like, it's too, it perpetuates this myth that there are people who can drink and people who can't.
Right.
And that there's a very black and white, there's a line. It's very clear and it's a black and white world, and it's not.
Right.
At all. Like, part of this is just this weird, baffling culture we have around alcohol, which is a whole other conversation I could get into.
Sure.
But it's just so odd to me that the way that we feel about alcohol and protect it and covet it in a way, it's just sort of this ubiquitous drug, because it is a drug.
Oh yeah.
I read this article over the weekend that was citing a new report that came out from, I want to get this right. A new report that came out from the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. It's like the NIAAA.
Yeah.
I knew that I was going to get that wrong if I tried to remember. And it just came out and it said basically that we are in like this national health crisis, that deaths among women particularly rose 85%. Alcohol-related deaths rose 85% over the course of 2009 to 2017. So it's like this massive, massive issue. And yet we just don't see it as a drug.
Right.
And in this article, it said, you know, if alcohol came out today as a new drug, it would be banned.
Oh, sure.
No questions asked. Yeah. It's the most dangerous drug. It causes more deaths than all the other drugs combined, on and on and on. Anyway, so part of it is that it's like, it's not really that I do believe in alcoholism. I do believe that some people, like, I have a thing that some of my friends just don't. It's obvious if you want, even the people who drink heavily, I just simply couldn't stop.
Yes.
And some people could take it or leave it, right?
Right.
But that's not to say that, like, there's a wide spectrum, a long spectrum of problematic drinking. And so this idea that if you're an alcoholic, that's the only label, if you wear that label, you cannot drink. It just perpetuates this whole story that I don't agree with,
right,
and that I don't really want to support. So there's that. And then it's also just like, I don't really care.
Yeah. I love that. Yes.
Like, I just don't care. Like, that is not how I want to identify myself. It's not the most important thing about me. It's not even like the top 50 most important things about me. So I just don't care. It's a weird thing for me to, it just always felt weird coming out of my mouth.
Yeah.
So there's that. And I think, like, then the whole other thing is, and I say this a lot in the book, is like, addiction is not that unique at right. all. Like, right. human condition is that we are addicted.
Oh yeah.
We have our tendencies. I mean, addiction is defined as anything you do despite negative consequences.
Right.
So, like, begin the list of those things. You know, yes. It's just that alcohol and a drug addiction happens to manifest in particularly ugly ways.
Right.
So we have, like, vilified it more. But we're all addicted.
Of course.
All of us. And so it's this very human condition that label just seems so odd.
Yeah, you know, Eckhart Tolle in one of his books nailed it. He was saying, you know, you think you're not addicted, and he's not an addiction, you know, specialist or writer, but
right.
he talked about that. He says, stop thinking, you know, like, just go ahead yeah. and stop thinking and don't think anymore.
Addicted to your thoughts.
Yeah.
Right.
Good luck. You know, like, and the fact that these incessant thoughts that we have are, for most of us, and even myself still, like, 20 years into this healing journey, like, I can still go down that spiral of, like, buying into or feeding into the negative thoughts that pop up and, you know, get addicted, and hence negative consequences. Not yep. like that with alcohol, where I'll end up in a jail cell or an emergency room or intubated or, you know, any of the number of near-death experiences I had. But
right.
still, negative consequences on the inside, which then affect my way of being in the world, and it's no bueno, you know, not good. So
right.
The other thing you said too that I thought was interesting is that it is such a protected, kind of coveted thing, this drinking, and especially, well, I was going to say in the West, but I think pretty much everywhere. I remember going to Rome, but it's not like a party alcohol thing.
And yeah, it's different.
Yeah,
it's different.
Right. So, you know, I'm engaged, and I've been with my fiance for 2 years, and mm-hmm. She drinks, like, she'll have a beer, like, maybe a few times a year, and that doesn't bother me. Like, I know in the big book, and I haven't attended a meeting in a long time myself, nothing against
yeah.
them, but, you know, there's still a lot of wisdom in that book, and I appreciate that book.
Yeah.
But, you know, they talk about how we can't expect the world to change just because we do. And, you know, so I'm around alcohol a lot, and that's fine because I write for magazines, and aside from books, and I, you know, write for music magazines and cover concerts, and it's just there. And
yep.
luckily I don't feel like called towards it. And I have friends that drink and they're not alcoholic and they can. Great. But my right. fiance, the interesting thing was being with someone such as myself who is sober, she had never like seen just how like
everywhere it is
immersed. Yes. Like culture yeah. is like based on it. And
oh, yeah.
to the point where she like barely ever drinks now just because
yeah.
she's so disgusted by it. it's yeah. And people don't
really.
Yeah.
It does that. Open your eyes. People that even do, you know, cause now there's dry January, which we're in the middle of. There's like dry right. July. There's
right.
sober October. There's, you know, 1 year, no beer. People who have done those,
yeah.
experiments have commented to me so many times about how they can't believe it's like, oh, now that I'm not doing it, I see it's everywhere.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I one thing, and you did start out at one point with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know that at least per your book, you were still using the 12 steps as guideposts. Mm-hmm. You still have a sponsor. Mm-hmm. And I want to make it clear that at least, you know, on my end, and I don't think on your end in any way, are we bashing the 12 steps?
Oh, God, no.
Yeah, because, I mean, they have helped me. And, you know, I've already quoted, you know, the big book a number of times. And I know people who swear by that and it saved their lives. And that's wonderful, to each their own. So I wanted to offer you an opportunity just to talk a little bit about the role that AA did play in your own journey and, you know, how that kind of morphed, I guess, the longer sure. you were there.
Yeah. So what I say in the book is like any criticism that I have to say about AA, which is really a criticism about the fellowship, not the program of AA, which right. is the 12 steps, is pales in comparison to the reverence I have for that program because it truly saved my life. The people there saved my life. I don't know that I would be sober without them.
Right.
That said, you know, I initially my criticisms of AA were that were really based on the fact that I didn't want to get sober.
Sure, of course.
So there was that. Yeah. But then once I spent a lot of time in meetings and you know, a lot, I went every day for several years and there was so much good there, but there was also stuff that I just didn't agree with. Like and I didn't there can be this very fear-based mentality in the rooms. And I'm not saying that this is every meeting. It's not how the program works
right.
as it's laid out, not how the text works, but it's the fellowship, the people. There can be this very fear-based mentality that I just didn't like. It was like, I can't feel, you know, you hear some people say like, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Yeah.
I just have today. God forbid I get away from the program, I'll drink. And, you know, they've been saying that for 20 years. And it's like, right. God, I can't imagine I can't fathom. It was depressing to me. Yeah. That felt really depressing. And then this idea of it is that part of the when I talked about, you know, really over identifying with alcoholism and being an alcoholic.
Yeah,
that was another aspect. So this over identification or how I see it as over identification, like it started to feel like very constricting to me and not expansive. And, you know, I also have to say, like, my work now, I quit my job. I worked in advertising. I quit it in 2016 and started doing what I'm doing now, which is a lot of work in recovery. I teach personal development courses. I talk about sobriety all the time. I did a podcast about sobriety for years. I write about it all the time. I just wrote a book about it. So I'm very like connected to that world every day.
Right.
And I think if I didn't have that connection, I would have maybe stayed. I would have kept going to meetings if that was my only way to connect with other sober people and to be connected with recovery.
Right.
But I had so much of that the meetings just felt like this isn't doing anything for me anymore. And I also stopped working in the city and so the meetings were different, you know, where I go in my town, the meetings are just different, which is also a thing that just is the way it is because the program is whatever location you're in and the people who are there.
Of course. Right. Right.
That's the experience you're going to have. And it varies widely. So it's hard because I love the program. I met so many wonderful people there. I'm forever indebted to it. But I also, it just wasn't, it felt very, it just wasn't where I needed to be.
Sure.
And I still have a sponsor. I love the steps. I probably will start, I go to meetings occasionally and I would love to get involved again at some point. I bet I will, but it's just, What I want people to know is that it's okay if your relationship is complicated with anything, right?
Right.
And I also want to say, I needed, like, what I was doing in the beginning was saying, AA is so dumb. I don't want to do it. I found all the flaws because I didn't really want to get sober.
Yep.
And I sort of said to myself, like, you know what? How about you get sober and stay sober for like a year or two, and then you can start, you know, criticizing things.
Right.
Let's see if you can do that, because that's what's most important. And I'm telling you, I don't know that I would have got to a year or 2 years if I didn't have all the meetings and the people and all that.
Yeah. So. And same here. And that's why, like, I never badmouth it whatsoever. As with like a lot of religions, I think you said, or I saw a note somewhere where you said, it's run by people, and people have a great way of ruining things, you know? And,
they do.
Yeah. And you know what? I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but you know, back in the 40s, and I've seen the pamphlets with my own eyes. And if you do enough digging on Google, you can find them too. But Bill had put out, you know, back then there was a lot more pamphlets than anything. And in some of them, he talked about the benefits of hallucinogenics for some people in recovery, mm-hmm. as well as Buddhism and various Buddhist teachings and practices, something you will not find or hear in most meetings today. And God forbid you mention the idea of some kind of alternate idea to healing
right.
that, you know, could alter the brain slightly. You know, it's, right. it's very scandalous.
It is very scandalous, yes, to some.
But, it's, you know, I just found it interesting that Bill, the creator, was, you know, a proponent for that, not for everyone, just like Gabor Mate, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with his work.
Love him. Yeah.
And I've had him on the show, and, you know, he's a big proponent for ayahuasca, says it's not for everyone, but he has seen it work miracles in people's
yep.
lives. And
yep.
So, you know, that's another thing where there is a lot of, you know, stigma and not just AA, any of the other fellowships where, you know, like, no, you can't. It alters your mind. And without actually researching or understanding that it doesn't have the same effect on the pleasure center or the reward center in our brains. And, you
yeah,
know,
also just that everybody's so different. You
exactly.
know, everybody's different. Like,
yes.
Yeah.
And
so
I appreciate you saying that, because, you know, the other thing I was going to say is that the one thing, and Gabor pointed this out in our conversation, and he's so correct, is that the one thing he finds that's significantly lacking in the 12 steps is looking at trauma. Yeah, the body and trauma. And so I'm sure you're familiar with Bessel van der Kolk's work, and Stephen Lamine, and, you know, all these wonderful people. And,
Peter Lamine.
Or Peter.
Like, who am I missing?
Stephen was a wonderful teacher who passed away years ago, friends with Ram Dass. Peter Lamine.
Peter Lamine,
yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, that whole group. And I love their work. And that's
my gosh, me too.
Right. Life changing. And that's what got me into EMDR therapy, which I do now. And nothing again against 12 steps, but I'll tell you, 20 years at this in EMDR and ART, which was born out of that, have been game changers for me.
I agree. And that's another, you know, it's not a criticism of AA. It's
right.
not supposed to be everything, but
right.
it's more of just something I didn't find there. So I went elsewhere to get it is the body and sort of dealing with trauma, specifically how to address trauma.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, so I don't know if you had started with meetings. Did you end up ever having to go? I don't recall from your book if you had to go into a detox or residential, or you just did straight up meetings. And
I should have.
Okay,
dear God. But no, I didn't. And I didn't know how bad it could be.
Sure.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
One, I was in denial about how much I was actually drinking.
Right.
Which was a lot.
Right.
And two, I just didn't know how bad detoxing could be. I thought, I really didn't know.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you brought this up. If in case there's people, I don't think most people know.
Yeah.
I think you think, oh, you're going to feel like you're hungover for a couple days.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
It's like the worst symptoms kick in 36 to 72 hours and you can die.
Absolutely.
It can be fatal pretty easily. I had no idea. I just was up awake for several days. I was hallucinating. I was completely out of my mind and truly like a horrific experience. But no, I didn't. And I should have. I really should have.
Yeah. I'm glad that, thank you for sharing candidly, because people aren't aware. You know, they think of like coming off heroin and, you know, like feeling like you're dying. And, but the only things you actually can die due to withdrawal symptoms are alcohol and benzodiazepines. So, medical attention, you know, depending on the degree to which you have gone with your alcoholism. Yes, it's very scary. I've been through withdrawal a number of times and wouldn't wish that upon anyone. It's brutal. But what I can say is I've also been through a number of residential programs aside from psychiatric hospitals and jails and all, you know, I've lived the life. And
you did it all.
I sure did.
Checked all the boxes.
Absolutely. But it's literally a miracle and nothing special about me, but a miracle I'm here. And I'm grateful, just like you were saying, you're connected with the community and doing the work you do, and very similar here. And I'm so inspired that I get to every week go down to a youth mental health and healing residential facility. So I'm working with teens 13 to 18 every week and two Sundays a month. And they, you know, it's tough to be a teenager. I didn't go into my first program until I was 24. But being a teen that age in a residential program where it's not just alcohol and drugs, but also suicidal ideations, attempts, self-harm, eating disorders. Yeah. But the beautiful thing about this program that I never had access to, and the ones I went to, because it was just don't drink, get a sponsor, go to meetings. Like that was the answer.
But I know.
As you said, we're all unique individuals. And that's what I love about this program, and I'm seeing more of it throughout the country, is they are taking that individual into mind. And so this program offers yoga, offers meditation, equine
more
therapy,
holistic, like integrative.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I just wish, you know, or am happy to see that that's happening. But really, that's what's needed, I believe, in the program. So anyways, moving on from that aspect of things.
Yeah.
Earlier you talked about guilt, and I know guilt and shame are not the same thing. They're, you know, definitely different. But this is something, and you have a chapter, Magnificent Monsters, and I know it's something you have a difficult time answering per what I read, some info that Kim had sent over prior to me reading the book. Okay. But then I read the chapter and I understand why. But I think shame, you know, it's such an important topic, and not just for people in recovery, just human beings.
Totally.
So, you know, with your experience of that particular, you know, you mentioned earlier being a mom and everything you've had to go through. I'm sorry to hit you with a heavy one, but this is such a,
important. It's so totally fine.
Cool. Yeah. So if you could talk a little bit about working with that and your experience and ultimately like how you've come to, I don't know, overcome it, if that's the right word, or at least like, you know, whatever,
work through it. Yeah.
Yeah. Work through it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, anyone who has, there's this word and there's phrase in the big book, it's incomprehensible demoralization.
Right.
And that is such an accurate description of what it feels like when you have suffered in addiction and have the things that you do and the things that you say, and there's so much shame around it. One, for just the fact that you can't seem to stop, because it seems like you just should be able to, and the world tells you you should be able to. But two, just we do dumb stuff, you know, we do stuff that is really out of alignment with who we are. Being a mom, you know, I say there's like a special vitriol for moms who drink, because it just flies in the face of everything that we're supposed to be, and this instinct that we're supposed to have with our kids. And I get that. Like, I get that it flies in the face of it. It really does. It didn't make sense to me either. So I was so smothered and by and in shame when in my, the last years of my drinking, really way before that. I was an ashamed person. Generally ashamed. I mean, shame is like thinking something is wrong with you, right? Whereas guilt is like you think you feel like you've done something wrong. Shame is like something is wrong with me. And I don't remember a time when I didn't feel that way, as a kid. And then what I say in the book is like I felt ashamed anyway, and then I created reasons to be ashamed. I guess the way that I worked through it, there were a few things. One was hearing other people talk about their stories. And there's so much freedom in that, and so much like I remember the first few meetings just feeling like someone had unlocked, like I had been had a rubber band around me for years, and someone finally like cut it, and I could breathe because people were saying things that I thought only I thought, said, felt, did, right? I thought it was just me. And of course it wasn't. And so I learned by listening to other people who had worked through their shame and weren't ashamed. I couldn't believe it. They would just tell their stories, and it was like no big deal. It's like, oh my God, how'd you do that? So, but it's because they had gone through it themselves. And then, so that helped immensely. And then I started to put together and talk about and straighten out my own story and say the things that I had never told anybody. And I, in that, I saw that I knew I had, like, when it came to my daughter, it's like, I know I love her fiercely. And yet I am doing these things like that put her in such danger. It doesn't make sense. And someone said to me, a woman said to me, addiction is stronger than love. Until it isn't. And it was like, oh, that's it. Because it just had to be, because there was no way I would choose to do that to her, like this thing had me. So that was a big piece. And then just really realizing that all of us have all the capacity for all the light and all of the dark, all of us, that's how we are. That's how humans are. And I would easily give that grace and compassion and understanding to other people, but I wouldn't give it to myself.
Of course.
And so I realized like I cannot beat myself into submission. I can't hate myself into changing. I can't. So I'm gonna have to love all the parts of me. And over time, a lot of writing, a lot of work, a lot of just remembering really, because once I stopped drinking, like it would have never been possible had I not stopped drinking, because I just kept creating new destruction and new reasons to be ashamed. But I learned, my book opens with this list of nine things, and I learned that it really wasn't my fault. I learned that all of it was my responsibility, all of it, everything, but none of it was my fault. Like, or at least, like getting addicted was not my fault. I never chose that. I didn't choose the reasons why I drank to begin with, which were things I had no control over, At some point, I said yes to drinking, of course, obviously, but I never chose to get addicted. And so it was almost like taking responsibility for what was mine and not taking responsibility for what wasn't mine anymore.
And just to clarify it, because I did want to share those nine things, if that's cool with you, with listeners, because I think it's such a beautiful way of conveying this, things that I've certainly learned myself through years of a lot of work, but I love the way you just simplify it and keep it, yeah, keep it simple. Let's throw another cliche out there while we're at it. But so, you know, you write what I just, and I love that this is how you start the book. It's right in the beginning. Number one, it's not your fault. Number two, it is your responsibility. Number three, it's unfair that this is your thing. Number four, this is your thing. Number five, this will never stop being your thing until you face it. Number six, you can't do it alone. That's so huge. Number seven, only you can do it. Number eight, I love you. Number nine, I will never stop reminding you of these things. Speechless. You know, like, that is so beautiful. So, like I said, I know I just kind of interjected, but that was something I was hoping you could talk and continue to elaborate a little bit more on that.
Yeah. So I actually created that list of nine things. It was I got a letter years ago from a woman who was really struggling because her sister was having a lot of problems with her drinking.
Yeah.
And she was struggling and she didn't know how to talk to her sister, and she was worried and she was angry and she was in, you know, her own hell, the hell that is watching someone you love be in the throes of addiction.
Right.
And she said, what do I say to her? And I wrote her this long letter, but at the end I wrote those things. And to me, it's just like everything I needed to hear, just summarized, you know, what I wanted people to say to me, what I needed to say to me. And it's just like, no matter what it is, no matter what your thing is, it's not just for people in addiction, but no matter what you're going through, when you're up against that type of pain, or as I call it, like your thing,
right,
then that's what I want people to hear.
And like I said, I love it as it's so just succinct and simple. It reminds me, I've shared about this, but I'll reshare it briefly because I think it's fully in context. There was a wonderful Trappist monk named Father Thomas Keating who passed away a few years ago. And I adored his work. He was from the mystic Christian lineage. And I remember this was probably about 10 years ago, maybe a little more. I was interviewing him and I don't remember how it came up in the conversation, but it was when I was still identifying as being in recovery. And I had mentioned that, and he kind of chuckled, not like in a mean way, but it was kind of a lighthearted way. And he said, well, I'm in recovery too. And I remember thinking to myself, oh shit, I didn't know Father Keating had a habit. Like, that's crazy. But his response was, I'm in recovery from the human condition and the varying degrees to which we all suffer and struggle, you know? And I was like, yes,
thank you.
Yeah.
And that's it.
It was like a light went off. And that for me was so big because it helped me realize I did have such blinders on that, like, you know, I'm in recovery from, you know, alcohol was my thing, but of course, what else, you know, alcohol and, or if nothing else is available, sure, alcohol, but all the meaningless sex and the overspending and just, you know, all of these terrible things that came along with it.
But
when he put it like that, I was like, yeah. So I love that when you say your thing, I do the same, you know, use different words, but it's like, you know, just replace the words drugs and alcohol or alcohol, whatever, with whatever your thing is, and shine a light on that. And I love that you do that because we're all human and we all have our thing or things, plural, no doubt about it. And that's why this book is so important, is that it might have the context of, the sobriety story, but it's not just for people that struggle with, you know, drinking or drugs. It's, I think, a universally beneficial read for literally anybody. If you're a human being, then this book is for you. That's my two cents.
I'm so glad you said that. I that's my hope.
Yeah, because, you know, and I say that because you're, again, that's the underlying thread. But for example, like a big part of this book, there's so many great takeaways. But one of them is you talk about your bigger yes, you know, which I know is a big part of your teaching. And I really, really dig that. The way that you kind of flip the way we typically look at things in life, and you challenge us to reframe the way that we're viewing them or questioning them. So this bigger yes, you had talked about it in a way of like stopping behavior in terms of what we're giving up, but that there's something bigger, you know, and we're moving towards that on the other side.
That's always
the bigger yes. So yeah, can you talk more about that? How to reframe that and the bigger yes?
Yeah, so the bigger yes came from, well, first of all, it came from the actual phrase itself, came from this Stephen Covey quote that says, you have to decide what your highest priorities are. You have to decide what your highest priorities are and have the courage, pleasantly, smilingly, non-apologetically, to say no to other things. And the way you do that is by having a bigger yes burning inside. So you have to decide what your highest priorities are, right?
Right.
Augustine Burroughs, who I adore, also wrote this magnificent essay in his book, This Is How. And in it, he says wonderful things. There's this one chapter essay called How to Put Down Your Drink, and it talks about how to get sober. And he says, what worked for me in getting sober was to find something I loved more than I loved drinking.
Yes.
And P.S., I didn't think that there was anything.
Right.
And I didn't either. I mean, it sounds so ridiculous to someone who doesn't get that, but right. I didn't. I wanted to keep that and do the things I wanted to do. I didn't want to have to say no to that. Right. So, so there was something though. I knew I had this big potential inside of me. I knew I wanted to be a teacher. I wanted so deeply and badly to be a writer. And when I started to try to get sober, I started writing. Because it helped me figure out what was going on with me. I just couldn't stop. I finally also had a story to tell. So I started to get glimpses of what it felt like to be in that space, you know, to be doing this thing that I so deeply wanted to do. And that I think is my gift. My gift is to use words.
Right.
Most importantly, it's just where I feel close. It's for me where I feel most closely connected to God.
Yes.
And to God is in like my truest self. So I had a sense of what that felt like. Right. And again, it took me like a year and some months where I was sober a little, and then I wasn't sober, and then I wasn't. So I got to in that time to get this glimpse of what it felt like to be sober and to start to write and to put, like, I tested these waters and I went, there are a few stories I could tell, but I went to this reading once. It was Elizabeth Gilbert actually. And, it was in Boston and it was like July of 2014. So I wasn't sober yet. I got sober finally in September. I remember being pretty hungover. I dragged my daughter along. It was like 95 degrees that day and sat in the front of the theater. I remember just barely being able to look at Liz do this thing. You know, she was giving a reading and answering questions because I wanted it so bad.
Yeah.
Like I wanted to be doing what she was doing and I wanted it so bad that it hurt.
Yeah.
And someone asked her a question like about writer's block or something, some sort of regular, you know, question that she probably gets asked all the time. And she's like, I don't really believe in writer's block. But, you know, there's all kinds of things that could stand in the way of you doing this thing that you want to do. It could be a relationship. It could be your health. It could be your geography. It could be alcoholism. It could be this. It could be that. She just like threw it in.
Right.
And I was like, oh, my God, you know, for whatever reason, I saw so clearly that I could, like, I would never do it if I kept drinking. I would never, it was one or the other.
Yeah.
That I could, I had the sense that I had this in me. Like I could write, I could maybe even publish a book, I could maybe even change my entire life to be a teacher.
Right.
But none of it was going to be possible if I kept drinking.
Yeah.
And so it was that saying no to other things by having this bigger yes inside. And then there's this quote that I always bring up as many times as I can, because it's the most powerful quote to me. And it's the Gospel of Thomas.
Yeah.
And he says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. And if you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. So it's like this unused potential in us is not a benign thing.
Right.
What grows in its place is this darkness and bitterness and depression. And we know it when we feel it, and we know it when we see it too in other people, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what had been happening to me. I mean, the addiction was killing me. The alcohol was killing me for sure. But this not using my potential that I was wasting my life.
Yeah.
Was really killing me.
I'm so happy you mentioned the Gospel of Thomas. That's my favorite of all the Gospels. I love the Gnostics, but that one is just, I've read so many different versions and translations, and the entire Gospel to me is wonderful. So esoterically close to Buddhism in many of the sayings. I love that is something you just brought up, and especially that part, because yes, so true. And
so true.
Yeah. And same, you know, one of my favorite sayings that I use all the time is the only way out is through, very simply, you know, like until we bring that unconscious material that Jung talked about, until we begin to reown and reintegrate that through whatever means and methods there are, that's the stuff that's like still there. And that for me was a big part of what kept bringing me back to relapsing and acting out and self-harm and suicide attempts. And that's why I said earlier, I can't stress enough, for me at least, the importance of the trauma-based therapy that I am still involved in, and how it shifted so much of my life, even prior to post writing. You know, I've been doing the work for a long time, but you know, similar to you, it's very interesting that I started writing, but not with the intention of becoming an author or a public speaker. That happened ass backwards for me, and it was a New York Times bestseller that read some of my stuff on a website that introduced me to my literary agent, and I saw, like, before our call, the people she represents, and I got really nervous because, you know, I didn't go to school for writing, I didn't plan on writing, and then, you know, now I have three books out, and two of them with Simon and Schuster, and
it's amazing.
Yeah, but the coolest part to me is that, and I write for these magazines, and I do the workshops with the teens, and they see like the endorsements I've gotten, and they know the magazines I write for, and they're like, that's so cool, blah, blah, blah. And I'm glad they see that, because it shows what's capable, like you said, once we stop whatever the self-defeating behaviors are that we're doing.
Right.
But the coolest thing, and I'm always very clear with them or with anyone I'm talking to, is that yes, that's cool on the material, physical level. But the nicest thing is that I woke up this morning and I was not hungover. I was not going through withdrawals. I was not running to the toilet to throw up. I was not shaking. I was not reaching for, like, hoping that there's a little bit left in my bottle just to get me through till the package store opens. Like,
oh my God,
that's
yeah.
The gift for me, the biggest gift.
Absolutely. And, yes. And it's so basic and so simple, and it never gets old.
No. And without it, what you're doing, what I'm doing, you're right, it wouldn't be possible. And yet here we are, just two examples. You know, there's countless examples of tragic losses well before their time, due to drugs and alcohol and other things of that nature. But mm-hmm. Here we are, nothing special about either one of us, except that we did the work. You know, I mean, we're all special in our own way, but we showed up and we did the work, and, you know, and we followed whatever life put in front of us. And now here we are doing that and giving back. And so, you know, all that to say, so much respect to you and
Thank you.
What you do in this book, which, you know, for the audience, again, the titles, We Are the Luckiest, The Surprising Magic of a Sober Life. We really scratched the surface. I know we sidetracked a bit, but I always enjoy doing that with my guests, because being interviewed a lot myself, I know it can get kind of tedious when you're asked the same questions over and over.
But
what I did want to end on, and then I'll give you, of course, a moment if there's anything we didn't cover, was just very quickly, I wanted to read from the inside jacket, the kind of about the book. So in case, you know, anyone or anything we didn't cover or is unclear, this, I think, does a very nice succinct job. It writes, "What could possibly be lucky about addiction? Absolutely nothing," thought Laura McGowan, when drinking brought her to her knees. As she puts it, she kicked and screamed, wishing for something, anything else, to be her issue. The people who got to drink normally, she thought, were so damn lucky. But in the midst of early sobriety, when no longer able to anesthetize her pain and anxiety, she realized that she was actually the lucky one. Lucky to feel her feelings, live honestly, really be with her daughter, change her legacy. She recognized that those of us who answer the invitation to wake up, whatever our invitation, are really the luckiest of all. Here in Straight Talking Chapters, filled with personal stories, McGowan addresses issues such as facing facts, the questions of AA, and other people's drinking. Without sugarcoating the struggles of sobriety, she relentlessly emphasizes the many blessings of an honest life, one without secrets and debilitating shame. And I think that's a really, really lovely about the book. Whomever you have at New World Library that wrote that, they did a great job. They did a really nice job. But that said, I always like to leave my guests with the last word. So, Laura, if there's anything that we didn't cover that you specifically wanted to make sure you left listeners with, the floor is all yours.
Oh my gosh. I think, you know, what I want people to hear most is that their pain is not such a problem. Like it's always an invitation to something. And when you're in the middle of pain, that can be the most annoying thing in the world to hear, but it's also so true. And I want people to hear that. Like, I want them to know that they have this invitation to a much bigger, more meaningful life.
I love that. And I think that that could not be a, I think, more apropos way of bringing this conversation to a close for now, because I feel like we have to definitely have you back on the show. There is so much more I want to talk to you about. And these are the times where I'm like, why do I have to be limited to an hour? But I get it. I understand. And we have things we have to do. But Laura, I really, like I said, I deeply appreciate you, the book,
work
you're doing in the world. It's so needed. And yeah, just much respect to you for that. And thank you for the time and being on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.